Blog Talk Radio.
As we discuss the world of sports, as always, the call number is 347-215-6180. You can follow me on Twitter at William Gerald, or you can hit me up on Facebook at facebook.com/SurrealQuinn, or go to SurrealGeraldQuinn.com. And the wait is finally over. The Final Four is here. Atlanta, which for the next 9 to 10 days is going to be the sports capital of the world. Final Four this weekend, next weekend, Masters, Tiger, the whole nine yards. So we'll be looking forward to that as well. We'll be looking forward to that as well. Big program, again, a busy, busy program. Not only Final Four action, obviously the opening week of the baseball season, a lot going on in the world of sports in terms of college athletics. Not all good, as we all know. And the NBA is starting to wrap up its regular season, thankfully, so we can get the playoffs started and get this, you know, so we can stop watching teams rest players. So a lot to do in this busy program. We're going to begin, though, with the Final Four. And to me, and I said this to somebody this week, or I might even say it on Facebook, this is a perfect Final Four combination. You have the heavy favorite in Louisville. You have two very good teams that struggled during at one point during the season, but are certainly Final Four and national championship caliber in Michigan and Syracuse. And you have the uninvited guest, the Cinderella, Wichita State. I mean, I think that is you knew coming into this tournament that this was going to be that, and I said this before the tournament, and I didn't have any brackets right. The only pick I had right in terms of my brackets was Louisville, and I had them in two of the five brackets that I did. But you knew that I got the sense that before the tournament that there was going to be no more than one top seed there, if not any top seeds. Turned out to be only one top seed in terms of Louisville. So you knew this was going to be a wild tournament. It has been. It certainly has lived up to that billing. And, you know, you had these two teams, you had these four teams that three of them probably can win the national championship. I keep disrespecting Wichita State. I know Wichita State is very good. I thought Wichita State had a legit chance to be Ohio State. Now, I didn't think they were going to be Ohio State, but I thought they had more than a legit chance to be Ohio State, and they took Ohio State apart. Very impressive with that victory before a late Ohio State run. But, again, you have a perfect combination. You have a perfect combination for a Final Four. And the one thing that's been constant, the one thing amongst these four teams that's constant, and something that's been constant over the course of this tournament, whether you love it or hate it, is defense. Now, Michigan doesn't guard anybody. We know Michigan gets pounded on the boards. They're not a good defensive team as far as our opponent's field goal percentage, but they make up for it in terms of what they can do offensively. But Louisville, Wichita State, and Syracuse are tremendous defensive teams, especially Louisville and Syracuse. What Louisville did to Duke last week was something that I don't think I've ever seen Duke. I haven't seen a team do that to Duke. I'll put it to you this way. I have not seen a team do that to Duke since the 1990 NCAA championship when UNLV beat Duke by 30 points. And that was like 23 years ago. I mean, and considering when that game was tied at 42-42 with about 17 minutes left. I mean, Duke was in that game. That was a back-and-forth game for about 23 minutes. But what those guards did to Duke and how they just pounded Duke on the backboard, they physically and mentally took Duke apart. I haven't seen it again. You don't see that done to Mike Krzyzewski coach team. You just don't. Syracuse's 2-3 zone this postseason is the ultimate weapon. I mean, you talk about if you were to ask me who, and you know, you get this question often when you get to a Final Four. Well, who's the best player? And a lot of people will say Trey Burke. Normally, I would say Trey Burke, but you know what? The best player, the star of this Final Four is the Syracuse 2-3 zone. It has been unstoppable. Teams are shooting 28% against it, 15% from three-point range. So you say, well, they should be giving up threes. No, 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 no. That's the beauty of the zone, of their particular zone. That's how athletic they are. They don't give up three-point shots. They match up out of that zone. I mean, they basically run a zone and a man at the same time, basically. It's a zone, but they play it like it feels like they're playing you man to man. Like you don't get room to operate. There's a way to attack it, but you don't. It's definitely not by shooting threes. And then you have Wichita State, which again has banged people on the backboards with the two big men, Early and Hall inside. The guards have been streaky with the 3-point shooting. They had the little point guard Armstead who's been all over the place. So, again, three of these four teams play tremendous defense. And then, you have Michigan, hail to the victor. First time they've been back in 20 years. The 20th anniversary, of course, of that 1993 national championship loss to North Carolina, which the Chris Webber timeout, which I'm sure you'll see over and over this weekend. People talk about that. 20 years. I can't believe it's been 20 years since that game. Michigan, you heard Jim Boeheim say, best offensive team in college basketball, the best point guard in college basketball, Hardaway Jr., Glenn Robinson Jr., and on top of it, they have a guy who is one of the best pure three-point shooters in the country, gets hot against Florida, Scott Stauskas, and then you have the emergence of a guy who I feel like is going to be a top five pick in a year or so, and Mitch McGarry, who has been, you can make a case, the best big man in this tournament. So you got a little bit of everything. You got two Big East, a Big Ten, Missouri Valley Conference. You have a favorite, a couple of aces, and an uninvited guest. A nice mix for this Final Four in Atlanta, as we are less than 6 hours away from Wichita State and Syracuse starting off, kicking off tonight, and then of course 40 minutes after that you'll have Wichita State and Louisville. Then of course 40 minutes after that you will have Michigan and Syracuse. Jim Boeheim. And Rick Pitino are the only coaches, along with Dean Smith and Mike Krzyzewski, to coach in four Final Four in Final Fours in four different decades, which is remarkable when you think about it. So those two have a chance to go at it, but certainly Wichita State and Michigan will have a lot to say about that. Just getting started here on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review, 347-215-6180 is your call number. When we return, we'll have today's headlines, and we're also going to talk some baseball as well. That's coming up, and much, much more on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back. Gallinari, Denver, the talented Denver small forward, is out for the rest of the season with a torn ACL. He was Denver's second leading scorer at about 16.2 points per game. We also have Ty Lawson, who is out right now. Lawson will be back before the season's over, more than likely. Or maybe they might hold him out to the playoffs, but he'll be back. It's a big blow for the Denver Nuggets. Again, he's a guy that can post up, shoot threes. He can put the ball on the floor. He's a stretch. He can be a stretch four at 6'10". Very versatile. Good player. Very good player. To be honest, he's just barely a notch below an all-star caliber player. Good news for them is, again, they'll get Lawson back. And Lawson's much more important to them than Gallinari as their point guard. Lawson's been tremendous this year. I mean, Ty Lawson has been quietly one of the better point guards in the league this year. And there are a lot of great ones in the league. I know there are a lot of great ones in the NBA, but Lawson has been just playing out of his mind, especially since the All-Star break. The good thing about Denver is, and this is where not having a superstar kind of helps or will help them, is that they're not dependent on one guy. And so that softens the blow for them a bit, not being dependent on Gallinari. Now, even if you were healthy, I didn't think Denver was a serious contender to do anything in the Western Conference. Maybe outside of winning the first round, I don't think they're as good as those big three as far as the Timberwolves, the Timberwolves. Oh, those big. I should say big two. Did I say the Timberwolves? Oh my goodness, maybe the Timberwolves of 2003. But the Thunder and the Spurs—they're not as good as those two. They could beat anybody else, to be honest, because if the West. The West is, even though it's top-heavy, none of those teams are dominant teams as far as Memphis or the Clippers. None of those other teams other than Thunder and the Spurs scare you. So I didn't think they were going to Duke. I mean, I didn't think they were major contenders anyway to go that far in the Western Conference. But again, still a big blow as he goes out with a torn ACL. And Denver's played great this year. They had a long winning streak. George Karl, obviously knew how good of a coach he is. And they've really, really bought to that concept of, not having a star and, having 10 guys, and they have one of the better, if not the best, home court advantage in all of the NBA. Rick Pitino and Jerry Tarkanian both have unofficially been elected to the Hall of Fame. The official announcement is expected to be made on Monday. Pitino, has been one of the best coaches of this generation. He's taken three different teams, of course, the Final Fours, beginning with his days at Providence. Then, of course, he had a powerhouse team at Kentucky, including the best team I've seen in myself in all my time. The 1996 Kentucky team was the best team in the last 15 or 20 years. I mean, that was a dominant team loaded with pros up and down the roster. Took that team to a championship. We're in the middle of going to three straight championships. He went to back-to-back championships and would have won back-to-back championships if not for Derek Anderson hurting his knee. Remember, Derek Anderson hurt his knee that year, and he was healthy enough to play in a championship game. But Pitino said, "Listen, if he was my son, I wouldn't play him." So he just allowed Anderson to shoot a couple free throws in. I don't know if there was a champion. I think it was the Final Four game in 97 that he allowed against Minnesota. I think he allowed him to shoot two technical free throws just to give him a feel of the Final Four. But they took Arizona to overtime without Derrick Anderson. They had Derrick Anderson with Ron Mercer and the other players that they had. They would have won a championship. It would have been three straight from 96 to 98. So without question, a Hall of Famer. Jerry Tarkanian, of course, the running Rebels, despite the allegations and all the stuff that they did. He took a mid-major turn. He was the last mid-major team, Power Six conference team to win a championship. Those University teams back in the day where Franklin was just loaded, especially from 1990-91 when they had Larry Johnson, Stacey Augman, Greg Anthony, Anderson Hunt, George Ackles, Everett Gray. I mean, those teams, that 91 UNLV team, I don't know, between the 91 UNLV team and the 99 Duke team, those are the two greatest teams that I have seen to not win a championship. Remember, that 91 team was undefeated going into the Final Four when they took on Duke for the second straight year. And of course, Duke pulled off that miraculous upset back in 91. So those two teams, I mean, he had some great teams there. Had some great teams there. Of course, won that championship against 1990, which is still to this day the largest championship victory of all time. 30 points as they destroyed Duke that particular night. That particular night in back in Denver in the NCAA championship. So Tarkanian and Pitino will be both going to the Hall of Fame. 347-215-6180 is the call number. Javon Alford, who's been a frequent contributor during the NCAA tournament, will be joining us in a few minutes to talk about the Final Four and National Championship, and maybe even a little bit of Rutgers, which has been just an absolute disgrace over the past week watching that unfold. I'll talk more about that later on the program. Again, we have a busy, busy program for you. A lot going on in the world of entertainment as well, as the movies lost a iconic figure. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the beginning or the start of a new season of one of the iconic shows in the last 15 to 20 years. So a busy, busy program. This is Cyril Quinn, and this is the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this latest edition of the Serial Queen Review, 347-215-6180. A Final Four weekend in both the men's and women's. And, of course, in the women's, you have one guest that was supposed to be there, not there. How about Baylor getting knocked out by Louisville? And Brittany Griner, who... And I'll get to this later because it's one of my Are You Kidding Me's. But how about them getting knocked out of the tournament coming off a season last year where they had one of the most dominant runs in recent NCAA tournament history? Brittany Griner, unstoppable, you know, player of the year, back-to-back years. And now you're going to have another battle with Connecticut and Notre Dame, which have played three classics this season. Notre Dame is looking to beat Connecticut amazingly for the fifth straight time, dating back to last season. So we'll certainly be keeping our eyes on that as well. A little bit of NBA here before I get into some baseball. And they just announced that Tony Parker is going to be out tonight's game against the Hawks with a sore neck. That's the thing about the Spurs that it's the reason why Oklahoma City is going to be in the NBA Finals again. The Spurs can't stay healthy. I mean, Ginobili with the hamstring. I mean, ironically, the oldest one of the group has probably been the most durable in Tim Duncan. And probably, you know, Adam Parker was having a tremendous season before he sustained these injuries. Now he can't stay healthy. Ginobili's been out. Duncan saying, look, I'm 36 years old and I'm healthier than both of you. I mean, so the Spurs just can't get out their own way as far as staying healthy. And that was the one thing that made me nervous about picking the Spurs to get to the finals. I just didn't think that physically that they can make it to the finals, that they can get through Oklahoma City. I think they definitely had the team and can match up with anybody, but they just don't have despite how many young players they have and despite how deep they are, their core players, Parker, Ginobili, and Duncan, are old. I mean, Parker's not old, but again, he's played a lot. Remember, he's been in the league since he was 19. He came in the league in 2001. He's been in the league about 11 years as a point guard. You know, that's a heavy thing. He's been going deep into the playoffs just about every year. It's a lot of wear and tear on the point guard. Duncan's just old, and Ginobili, who's an age younger than Duncan, but probably Ginobili's probably like 40 in terms of his body, just cannot, you know, that herky-jerky style just can't stay healthy. And if you're Greg Popovich, I just think that they're far enough ahead of the number three team to where you can see the number one seed to Oklahoma City and say, hey, let's just get healthy. I know you went to number one seed in the West. You can forget about home court advantage throughout the playoffs because Miami's got that basically wrapped up, barring a collapse. So I think at this point, if you are if you're Greg Popovich, you want to go to Miami Heat route and just start resting players. Also, you had the Lakers winning last night, ugly game against Memphis, a Memphis style of game that the Lakers won surprisingly, 86-84. So Lakers remain a half game ahead of Utah in the race for the eighth spot. Of course, Lakers have played more games than Utah, which is I think Utah has played more games than the Lakers, which is an advantage for Utah because Utah is just a half game behind. Utah has the tiebreaker, so the Lakers' room for error is very small. Lakers still have a relatively tough schedule. So the Lakers might get lucky because I don't know how they still have to play San Antonio, but I don't know if San Antonio will play as people at that point in the season. Have Houston. Houston really is not playing for anything, to be honest with you. They're going to be locked into the number 7 seed. The key game for the Lakers playoff hopes will be fired tomorrow night, tomorrow afternoon, I should say, against the Clippers. So that if the Lakers win that game, I'm not going to say that's going to lock up a playoff seed for them, but that will put them in a good spot if they were to win tomorrow. But again, Clippers beating them three times this year, Clippers would love no more than to clinch the division and to cripple the Lakers' playoff hopes by beating them in a game, a nationally televised game. Knicks have won 11 straight. Carmelo, another 40-point game. I hate to throw rain on the parade, but they're playing for second. I mean, let's be honest, everybody in the East is playing for second. I mean, Miami is so by far better than anybody else. It's not even funny. Miami rest their players and still win games by double digits. And again, I know it was against Charlotte, but still, I mean, they're just making it look easy right now. And listen, can't knock Miami for doing what they're doing right now as far as resting players. When you win 27 straight games, you put yourself in a position where you can rest players. They're going to have the best record in the NBA. They by far have the best record in the East. Wade's banged up anyway, so he needs to rest. And you want to get LeBron some extra, you want to get some LeBron couple extra games to get healed off of the playoffs, and so be it. I mean, I really don't care, to be honest with you, because at the end of the NBA season, you don't care about those games. You don't care about these games anyway, especially for a team like Miami, a team like San Antonio. You're just looking forward to the playoffs. Like, these games are only exciting for, the Lakers and Utah and Dallas, who are fighting for their playoff lives. Everybody else is basically locked into to their particular positions within the NBA playoffs. And again, as a fan, you're just waiting for the NBA playoffs to begin. So, can't knock Miami for resting players. I mean, you can't. Listen, they did the same thing last year and won a championship. So, it's worked. That formula worked for them well last year, and it seems to be working again this year. And they're playing hard, and they're still playing. Bosch is still playing. So, it's not like they're resting everybody. Baseball last night, Washington gets knocked around by Cincinnati, 15-0 in Cincinnati. Cincinnati, six home runs. They, on a given night, the Reds can do that to you with that offense. They have a great offense. It's going to be a lot of fun watching those teams, go at it for a record, race for best record. I think the race for the best record is going to be between Cincinnati and the Nationals. Also, you had San Francisco earlier in the day shutting out St. Louis. How good is the San Francisco pitching staff so far through four games? Their starting staff has not given up an earned run, and they faced two very good lineups in L.A. and also St. Louis. So it's not like they're facing San Diego and Seattle. They face two big-time lineups, and they have not given up an earned run. You have Zito go seven strong, three hits, no earned runs. San Francisco, this is what they do. They play what they call torture baseball and hold you, shut you down from a pitching standpoint, eke out a run, and then take you apart in terms of their bullpen and win the 1-0, 2-1. They've made a living of winning those types of games. And again, those three heavyweights in the National League is going to be controlled by those three teams: Washington, Cincinnati, and San Francisco. Now, Atlanta is very good. St. Louis, I think, is very good. The Dodgers are very good. Who knows? Colorado might have a bounce back gear. Arizona and Colorado might have bounce back gears. I haven't seen enough yet to say that. Milwaukee, who knows about them? But those three teams are going to control the National League. As a matter of fact, those are the three best teams in all of baseball. And Washington, San Francisco, and Cincinnati. Those are the three best teams in baseball. And for this first time in a long time, the best teams in baseball reside in the National League. Because, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Yankees and Red Sox are not the Yankees and Red Sox. Chris Davis gotten off to a fast start. 4 home runs, 16 RBIs, batting 600 through his first 4 games. Listen, Baltimore can hit. And it's not just Chris Davis. I mean, you have Adam Jones. You have Nick Markakis. I mean, the team can hit. J.J. Hardy. That lineup is strong up and down the board. Up and down the board. They're going to score a Matt Wieters, who will certainly be getting locked up soon as far as contract extension. He'll be the next you know, budding star to get a contract extension without question. So the Orioles are going to score the Orioles are going to score runs, no question about it. Can the pitching staff hold up like it did last year? Remains to be seen, but they get a win over Minnesota 9-5, courtesy of a Chris Davis grand slam. Again, very few players in the history of the sport have gotten off two faster starts than Chris Davis is. I mean, 16 RBIs through 4 games, 4 home runs through 4 games, and he's off to, again, a tremendous start. And so is Michael Morris of Seattle Mariners, who kind of got lost with what happened with the Nationals last year. He was injured. He was banged up. This guy can hit. Remember the type of year he had back in 2011? He was an all-star, silver slugger, copper player. Still young. He's gonna definitely do some good things down there with that Seattle lineup, which is improved. You got Morris, you got Jesus Montero. They got some nice pieces in that Seattle offense. Yankees off to a slow start, no surprise with all the injuries they have, and then of course Eduardo Nunez gets hit by a pitch against Detroit yesterday, so another guy. Who knows how long he's going to be out. Now you hear that Jeter is going to be out until at least May. Again, when Jeter comes back, he comes back. I think if you're a Yankee fan, you have to kind of, like, just hold your breath and wait, you know, wait till some of these players start to come back. There's nothing the Yankees can do but pitch well or try to pitch well. You have to hope that your starting staff and your bullpen can hold the fort down. You can hover around 500 until you start getting some of these guys back. The good news for the Yankees is you are in a division where nobody's going to run away. Baltimore, Toronto. Toronto is off to a slow start too. Baltimore, Toronto, even Tampa Bay, they're not running away with that division. It's not going to happen. So that is the good thing if you're a fan of the New York Yankees, that nobody is going to run away with that division. But they're off to a 1-3 start, and again, 155, 156 games left. Still a lot of baseball to be played. So no time to panic by any stretch of imagination. Not even close to a time to panic if you are a New York Yankees fan. One thing you should be panicking about if you're a Yankees fan is the future of your franchise. Because I don't know if you've noticed, but there have been a lot of young, talented players being locked up contractually by their teams, whether it's Elvis Andrews, whether it's Buster Posey. And again, I said Matt Wieters will be the next guy. You had Adam Jones last year. You have all, you know, Felix Hernandez, Justin Verlander. Kershaw will be the next guy. And there's no way, nobody's going to outbid the Dodgers for Clayton Kershaw. He's going to be the next highest paid pitcher without question. He'll pass Verlander in terms of being the highest paid pitcher of all time. 25-year-old left-hander who's arguably one of the best top two or three pitchers in the game. But with that being, with all these guys being locked up financially, that leaves nothing on the free agent market. Nothing. And that's how the Yankees have won have been competing over the last decade or so by picking up. Man, I mean, Yankees have been doing that for years. Matter of fact, even going right back to the days when they signed Catfish Hunter and guys like that back in the day. Reggie Jackson. I mean, that's how the Yankees have won championships. And that's how they won their last championship. I mean, they went out there in that offseason of 2008, going to 2009 season, and signed CeCe Sabathia, who was the best pitcher on the market at the time, and Mark Teixeira, who was the best offensive player on the market at that particular time. And lo and behold, voila, they won a championship. Those type of players will not be on the market come 2014, 2015, 2016. Robinson Cano will be by far and away the best player on the market. And they already have him, so that's really not like adding anybody. Now if you're the Yankees, you're trying to make sure that you keep him. It's more than likely they will, but it's no guarantee. Now it's more time, more pressure. It's more pressure now than there's ever been to keep a Robinson Cano. Before that, remember, listen, it's a new day for the Yankees. I mean, they're trying to get under this luxury tax, which basically is a salary cap. Let's be honest. In baseball, the luxury tax is a salary cap for the Bostons, for the Yankees, for the Dodgers, for those teams of the world. And, you know, Dodgers don't care about it, though. Yankees do at this point. Yankees want to get under that salary, under that luxury tax number. They want to be under $189 million. That's their number. So I don't know how, again, the Yankees are going to build in terms of moving, are going to build moving forward. You have no bullpen. I mean, excuse me. You have nothing in your farm system. And listen, I like what baseball has done here. Baseball has put the emphasis more about less about spending money, and more about player development. And developing your farm system, because here's the thing: if you have a top farm system, not only can you get players and develop them, and to where you don't have to spend money from free agents in terms of free agency, but you have pieces that you can use as trading chips to get a David Price or to get a Robinson Cano if a team feels like they can't sign them, re-sign those players. And that's how it should be. I mean, it should be about shouldn't be about who has the most money to spend. It should be about who is doing the best job as far as drafting, player development, scouting, farm system. It should be about that in baseball, to me, more than anything. 38 minutes after the 12 o'clock hour in this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. When we return, we will get into some entertainment news. A lot going on, a busy weekend as far as a iconic show returning, and of course a loss of a legend. We'll be right back. Minutes after the 12 o'clock hour in this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. 215-347-215-6180 is your call number. We did a special on Wednesday about AIDS prevention and basically AIDS in America. And again, I'd like to thank Renee Lady Bird Burgess for joining me in terms of doing that particular program. I thought it was something that needed to be talked about on this program, and she did a tremendous job with that interview, so definitely a shout-out to her And as always, you can catch the archive of that program. It was done on the 3rd, yes, April 3rd. So it's the April 3rd program. It'll be titled Cyril Quinn Review Special Report. Easy to find. Catch the archive and replay it at any time on Blog Talk Radio. But just a tremendous job by Brene Burgess, even though she's a Celtic fan. You know, we'll forgive her for that. At least one night we were on the same team, so we had certainly enjoyed that particular program. It's something that needed to be addressed, that needs to be continuously addressed. It's been addressed, but it doesn't get addressed enough. She mentioned it over the course of the program, talking about, you know, December 1st as just the one day people pit as an AIDS, and which is ridiculous. Should be, you know, unfortunately, I mean, she has to live with it every single day of her life. But even if you're not living with it every single day of your life, it should be something that should be focused on over the course, day in and day out, because it's that serious, especially amongst African Americans. So good job, Al Renee. Good job, Al Renee, with that particular program. Again, catch the archive of that program anytime on Blog Talk Radio. Entertainment news: Roger Ebert, of course, is dead at the age of 70. One of the most recognizable and most iconic movie critic and that's ever lived, period. I myself don't listen to critics at all, for the most part. You know, I'll follow Rotten Tomatoes, and that's, you know, I'll follow Rotten Tomatoes in terms of what they think about movies, but that's a group more than it's individual. But Ebert was the one guy. Siskel and Ebert, I really didn't don't care too much for Richard Rover, to be honest with you, but especially when it was Siskel and Ebert, that was my CTV. If you were a fan of movies, I just love to see them argue. Those were the best shows, those two, when they disagreed. And when they disagreed. I mean, it was like this is the worst movie of all time. No, this is the greatest movie of all time. Like, that's how far apart they would be in opinions. And it would be fascinating to watch, because it gave you listen, movies are art. Art, as we all know, is subject to interpretation. So, you know, what may be treasure to you may be trash to me. And that's how it goes sometimes. But it was just fun watching those two go at it. Then, of course, they had the untimely death of Gene Siskel back in 1999 at the age of 53. Of course, you know, took that show in a different direction. They went Ebert and Roper, and I still watched it for Ebert. Again, I don't care too much for Richard Roper, not personally, but just, you know, as a movie critic, I really don't follow him that much. But Ebert was a transcendent figure, and it's not that often that you have some person transcend anything. You know, he was the guy that, again, that you had to watch, and you actually cared about his opinion. And, you know, the one thing he did was, you know, and this guy was a highly intelligent guy. I mean, this guy was a ferocious reader, just basically a scholar in terms of movie, like a walking movie encyclopedia. But he came off. He didn't come off as pompous. He didn't come off as, I'm better than you, I know more than you. He came off as a regular Joe who loved movies and who would just give you a real opinion on what he thought about a movie. If he loved it, he'd tell you he loved it. If he hated it, he'd tell you he hated it. It's just that simple. And certainly you have to respect that. Again, he was in the game for a long time, 46 years as a critic, 31 years on television, even after he lost his ability to speak due to surgeries that he had to have on his jaw, had to have his jaw removed, had, you know, thyroid cancer, and certain thyroid cancer. He still was able to communicate through the internet and through Twitter and things, and then took advantage of that. And again, he certainly will be missed. Again, dying dead at the age of 70. Again, that's the ultimate testament of greatness, is staying power. Again, you're talking about a guy who, in 46 years as a critic at the Sun-Times, 31 years on television, and not for the sickness, would still be doing it today, right now. He loved movies that much, and again, he will definitely be missed without question. Robinson Cano signs with Jay-Z's Roc Nation. Victor Cruz is going to follow. Listen, I understand how successful Jay-Z has been in all his ventures, whether it be Rockaware, whether it be S. Doc Carter's the Reebok, with Reebok, had Sean Marion and Kenyon Martin with them not too long ago. And they might still, could be still with them. I haven't heard too much about it in the recent years. And listen, Jay-Z puts his hand, I mean, he's like King Midas. I mean, whatever he touches turns to gold. But if you're Robinson Cano, you've been with Scott Boras, you know, basically since your career started, since you were basically, what, 17, 18 years old, first signed the contract. Scott Boras has made a lot of players a lot of money. I mean, some of the biggest contracts, you know, Scott Boras was engineered Alex Rodriguez's contracts, both of them, in excess of, you know, about $500 million. You know, so, you know, Scott Boras, and you can say what you want about Scott Boras, he's not the most liked person in baseball, around baseball circles, but it's not a popularity contest. He just gets the job done. My concern would be that you're turning over your career off the court to someone who has many different ventures in Jay-Z. I mean, Jay-Z's into music. He's, you know, doing commercials. He's doing a million different things. Let's be honest. You know, with Jay-Z's all over the place. Versus someone who is specific in terms of Scott Boras, who is specifically focused on putting money in your pocket. I would lean towards the guy who is going to put money in my pocket. Now, maybe Scott Boras feels like, maybe Robinson Cano feels like, you know, Jay-Z can help him post-baseball, which I don't know how. I mean, unless Robinson Cano, does anybody know Robinson Cano is a rapper? I would think that Scott Boras would have some type of plan for Robinson Cano post-baseball. But maybe he doesn't. Maybe that's the difference. But I just wonder. Jay-Z will not be like Master P was to Ricky Williams. I give Jay-Z more credit than that. I mean, Master P, you know, negotiated one of the worst contracts in the history of the world with that Ricky Williams contract back in, I believe it was 99 or 2000. He won't be that. Jay-Z has the stuff. He's a better businessman than Master P. But again, turning over the keys to somebody who has a singular focus versus somebody whose focus is all over the place, just kind of wonder about that. We'll see how it works out. I mean, obviously Jay-Z has drawing power. Victor Cruz, who is in the midst of wanting a new contract with the Giants, is also going to join Jay-Z's Roc Nation. If he hasn't joined, I think he's joined it already. If he hasn't joined it, he's going to be joining it soon. So we will see how that works out. Again, I wonder myself about the end game to all of this. Jay-Z's going to be fine. He's going to be fine. It's the athletes that would certainly be concerned. Like, if this doesn't work out, Jay-Z's still going to have, you know, $300 or $400 million in the bank, and Beyonce at his size. Oh, he'll be good. Victor Cruz, Robinson Cano, I don't know. I quite don't know about where they're going to stand when this all is said and done. Mad Men comes back for another season number 6, of course, on AMC. Listen, the funny thing about this show, I have not watched it consistently since probably, I would say, season 1, maybe even 2. For this audience, from our listening audience, and you can't ignore a show like this when you're doing the entertainment section of a program, which I do. I'm going to watch this season. Now, it is the craziest thing ever to try to jump into a program, a series in its 6th season when you haven't watched the previous 4, basically the previous 5, and I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm going to do it anyway. I watched the last couple of episodes of season five. Season five finale was tremendous. The whole idea that his, you know, he finally gives his wife the opportunity in terms of the commercial shoot. You got the mother-in-law. You got her messing with one of his coworkers. You got the coworker high on LSD. There's a lot going on. You got Joan, you know, flexing her muscle in terms of womanhood, and she's with the guys now. As far as there's just a lot going on. I loved it. It felt like a season finale. Then you got, of course, Don at the bar, you know, with the girl asking me, is he alone, which obviously was a loaded question. But I love the direction in terms of where they're taking the show. Next, you know, tomorrow, of course, you're going to have the two-hour season premiere, which can be tricky. Because think about it, The Wire, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, those shows never did those big premieres like that. Now, The Wire has done two shows that have been, one show was an hour and 20 minutes at the season four finale. The season five finale, the series finale was an hour and 30 minutes. That was it. Those are finales. Those shows normally don't do big time premieres. They normally give you the regular hour and keep it moving. So it'll be very interesting to see Mad Men try to navigate a two hour premiere. Obviously, is a very important to the season. It's going to set the tone of the season for those particular 2 hours. So I'm going to watch the show, follow it this season in particular. You have one more. They say they have one more season left in terms of season seven, not set in stone, but basically season seven is probably going to be the last season. So I'll follow it. Just for you, as my listening audience, I will watch the show and see if Don Draper changes his ways, which I doubt it. Don is who he is. One movie I'm going to recommend that's coming out this weekend, I would say The Place Beyond Pines. It's called The Place Beyond Pines with Ryan Gosling. Yeah, Ryan Gosling, Bradley Cooper, Eva Mendes. One of those movies that just looks good. It's set in Schenectady, New York. Basically about the sins of a father, about fathers and how that gets passed along to their sons. Ryan Gosling plays a criminal who just got out of jail. Eva Mendes has his child. He doesn't know it's his child. She's met some dude who's taking care of the child, doing a good job taking care of the child, and then it goes from there just out of control. He's an ex-criminal, and then you have Bradley Cooper's the cop. Eva Mendes, very interesting turn for her, seeing her playing a serious role for once. So that's a movie I would recommend for this week. Not G.I. Joe. Of course, next week we'll talk about, because I'm going to go see it, we'll talk about 42, Jackie Robinson's story. I'll tell you, give you my thoughts on that. Coming up on this last edition of the Cyril Quinn Review, college athletics and the story at Rutgers, we'll talk about that. And also collusion in the NFL. Really? We'll talk about that and much, much more in this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back. Thank you. 55 minutes after the 12 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Serial Corner Review. 347-215-6180 is your call number. So Rutgers almost cleaned his house. You have Tom Pernetti out. You have Mike Rice, the coach, out. John B. Wolf, general counsel, resigns. But you still have Robert Barchi, the president, who somehow keeps his job. Despite the fact that, you know, he knew about the tapes back in December. Everybody knew about these tapes in December in terms of the big wigs, as far as whether it's Pernetti or Barchi. Okay, Barchi just didn't watch the tapes. For whatever reason, he didn't watch the tapes when they first came up. For whatever reason. Which makes no sense. I mean, somebody comes to you, you're the president of the university, you're in charge of everything, including the interscholastic athletics, which shouldn't be, but it is what it is. And somebody comes to you and says, your athletic director comes to you and says, hey, we have to suspend our coach for 3 games. He did something. He had conduct that recommended a suspension. He's also on zero tolerance. Wouldn't you want to know why he's on zero tolerance? I know you have a million other things to worry about as president of a major university, which Rutgers is. You're about to move into the Big Ten. But wouldn't you be a little curious on, okay, what happened? What's going on? Just a little curious. Instead, the president says, okay, all right, do what you have to do. Let's move on. Until ESPN comes out with these tapes showing this guy basically going medieval on his players. And, of course, Pernetti, who should have fired Rice to begin with, I don't care what the lawyer said. No, that's a bunch of nonsense. We can't fire him due to two contractual things in his contract. Please, you can fire. Anybody can be fired at any time. Come on, let's be real about that. Anybody can be fired at any time. But, you know, you have a situation where the athletic director basically was scapegoated. He was scapegoated. He should have been fired. Everybody who's connected to this should be gone. Everybody, athletic director, president, coach, anybody that had any connection to this situation should be gone. Bottom line. I don't see how the Board of Governors can sit up there and support Barchi and separate him from the actions of Pernetti and Rice. I just don't get it. How does he, as the president, have no accountability, not being held responsible by people above him? I don't get it. Even the government support everybody's supporting them except the media. Why? I mean, the faculty called for Pernetti to get fired. Why didn't call for him to get fired? Oh, why? Probably because he's probably going to put millions of dollars into the university because of the new medical program he's trying to implement or whatever, science program. But, you know, we've seen this type of thing before. Here's the thing. Here's the way I'll say. There needs to be a voice for the kid, for the people who actually got hurt and were affected by the situation. And that was the students, the players, who had to deal with that nonsense for basically an entire year. And God knows how long. I mean, who knows what he did without tapes or who knows how long he had been doing that in various other practices. Thank God that you had somebody tape it and it finally got exposed. but there needs to be a voice. I mean, I think that I think that Division One men's, women's, I think they need a union. Somebody to speak up for them. I think it'll never happen because people don't, you know, the NCAA doesn't do things in the best interest of the students. They do things in the best interest of the NCAA and to put money, more money in their pockets. Nobody cares about the students. They don't. I mean, they care about them enough to make money off them, but overall, the best interests of the students are never taken into account. No matter how much the students are affected, the kids are affected. I mean, I just would like to see students have a voice in terms of whether it's getting paid, whether it's, you know, how they're being treated. But they don't have a voice, unfortunately. Three four seven 215-6180 is your call number. When we return, we will have a "Are You Kidding Me?" and also talk to the NFL. We'll be right back on this. We'll be right back on this edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. Hour in this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review on this 6th of April 2013. Final Four weekend, of course, Louisville, Wichita State, Michigan, and Syracuse. National Championship, of course, on Monday night. 347-215-6180 is your call number as we discuss the world of sports. Mark Cuban has said that if Baylor's Brittany Griner is available, it's the best player on the board in the second round, that he would consider taking a flyer and drafting her.
Are you kidding me?
I hope that he was joking. But with Cuban, you never know. I mean, Cuban is a PR freak. He'll do anything, even embarrass and ruin a girl's career to draw more headlines for himself and attention to himself. If you're Brittany Griner, I hope people around her just let her know that you can't play in the NBA. Don't even dream about it. It's one thing, you want to play against dudes in a street ball game, like pickup games on the side is one thing, but Don't play against dudes in the summer league. Don't play. Don't even think about it. There's no way she would get destroyed against grown again playing against dudes, NBA players. It just wouldn't work out well. I mean, listen, Louisville, okay, had it on lock. That was one of the reasons why Baylor won that. By Louisville beat Baylor. That I mean, they double teamed, triple teamed, and these are girls. So what would grown men do to her? She's a power forward on the women's college game at 6'8", 170. I mean, physically, it wouldn't work out well for her. It just would not turn out well. I don't understand why every time we have a big-time college women's player who's just off the charts, why people think that they could possibly play in the league, or that topic is even broached. I mean, it's never going to happen. You know, they have a WNBA. There's a reason why men play against men and why women play against women. You know, it's cute when kids are growing up. You have the one tomboy girl who plays all the sports, who may be kicking all the boys' ass at the age of 10, 11. That's cute, and that's whatever. That's fine. I obviously have no problem with that. But grown, you know, you're talking about, again, these are grown men. The NBA, the NBA stands for one thing, no boys allowed, okay? And that's even college players who are not ready. Physically not ready are going to get their ass kicked in the NBA, let alone a female. So, again, hopefully people around Brittany Griner are telling her, you know, to stand clear of this. Because she's the only one that's going to lose here. Cuban, you know, he'll get a couple of laughs, generate a couple of extra dollars. But she's the one that will get embarrassed. Roger Goodell has ordered cameras in all 32 NFL locker rooms to enhance the NFL fan experience. I don't understand how this enhances the NFL fan experience. What is it that you would be allowed to see in a locker room that would have, and that you as a fan would be have any interest in? Now, I would love to see what was said in terms of X's and O's and things of that nature, halftime adjustments. I'd love to see that, but they're not going to show you that. They're only going to show you things that, Aaron Rodgers' locker with, how many cleats Aaron Rodgers keeps in his locker, how many game day jerseys that players have. I mean, it's stuff that's just, it makes zero sense. The NFL will do anything to milk a dollar. It is remarkable the lengths the NFL will go to milk to make more money. Some of the stuff is just becoming just stupid. So one thing, you're talking to me about an 18-game schedule, things like that, to raising television contracts, that's regular business, but come on. Cameras in locker rooms. I know, I believe Dallas might have had one last year. I think they were the only team. But now this is a requirement. This is a requirement. It's not something you choose as a franchise. This is something that's mandatory as a franchise. Ed Rush, the former Pac-12 coordinator of officials, has resigned, and this is why he resigned. He says that he has lost the trust of the Pac-12 coaches in terms of affecting positive change.
Are you kidding me?
Now, if you've not kept up with this story, before the Pac-12 tournament, Ed Rush met with a number of officials and basically had a come to Jesus talk with them. We got to get tougher. These coaches are out of control. What is it going to take me, to send you to Cancun or $5,000? What is it going to take? And apparently, Sean Miller was targeted in that discussion by people in the room who came out and said this. Of course, they didn't identify themselves. And then, then you have Sean Miller gets teed up during a game against UCLA where his team loses by 2 points. Miller claims that he only said he touched the ball on a double dribble call that didn't go his way. He got technical foul. You have Larry Scott, the commissioner of the Pac-12, comes out and says he didn't get a technical foul for that. He got a technical foul for stepping outside the coach's box 3 times, which is just insane. You know how many times coaches step outside the coach's box? I mean, if coaches got technical fouls on that, then they wouldn't last past halftime. I mean, coaches, there is no coach's box as far as I'm concerned. You can't even tell where the coach's box is at because the coaches don't. Nobody stays inside the coach's box. So that was a bunch of nonsense. So Ed Rush, you know, who used to coordinate, and who is world class in terms of knowing how to do his job, as far as knowing, understanding officiating. He's a longtime NBA official. Did a lot of great work for NBA officials and officiating, showing them the details in terms of how to officiate and things of that nature. There's no question that Ed Rush knows what he's doing as far as that concerned. But a lot of people around the Pac-12 says that he's a bully and says that he had too much power. And the bottom line is Ed Rush had to go because there's no way that Arizona could trust that they would receive a clean whistle in terms of what transpired over the course of the Pac-12 tournament. There's no way. So he resigned. He resigned a mix under pressure and scrutiny from coaches, from media, from universities all around the Pac-12. He resigned under pressure. But for Ed Rush to come out and say that he lost trust in terms of the Pac-12 coaches affecting positive change, when did it become a coach's job to affect change in terms of officiating? How's a coach going to help officials become better, referees become better officials? I don't understand that one. He lost me with that. Coach's job is to put his team in the best position to succeed and to run a program, whether it's basketball, football, whatever they're coaching. It's not a coach's job to help make these officials better at what they do. It's nowhere near being a coach's job. So what Ed Rush said exactly just makes zero sense. Again, he had to go. I think he was secretly forced out, to be honest, in my opinion. But, you know, Larry Scott said, of course, Larry Scott came out there and said that, you know, he supported Rush. Did Rush make a mistake in his comments? Yeah, but he didn't deem it to be a fireable offense, but as you see now, a couple of days later, you have Rush resigning from that position, which is the best possible thing for the Pac-12, for him to get out of there. Because there's no way that, especially Arizona, that any other coach in that conference could trust a clean whistle moving forward. There's no way. (347) 215-6180 is your call number. When we return, we'll have some NFL news, and we'll also break down the Final Four. That's coming up on this last edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back. minutes after the 1 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. Some afternoon baseball. You have the Nationals trying to rebound off their first loss of the season against the Reds. Russ Detweiler on the mound for the Nationals. You have the Mets and the Marlins. Marlins got their first win of the season last night against the Mets. So you have those two games going on for some afternoon baseball. Good week. Good opening week so far for the baseball season. Again, you're going to have to watch out for that three-headed monster in the National League in regards to the Nats, Giants, and also Reds. And again, the American League is as wide open as it's ever been. There's nobody that's even come close to being a dominant team in the American League. It really is wide open. All those divisions. Well, listen, Detroit's going to win their division. I think Detroit is certainly the class of the AL Central, but the AL East and the AL West are frankly wide open. So, and the wild card is going to be wide open as well. So, American League wide open. National League will be dictated by three teams. Earlier this week, Players Association President Damaris Smith came out and basically is trying to prove collusion amongst NFL teams of keeping salaries down. Now, if you notice, NFL free agency this year has been as slow as it's ever been. You haven't seen a lot of money tossed around, and you've seen a lot of one-year contracts. Matter of fact, Mike Wallace is the only free agent that signed a contract in excess of $10 million a year. Everybody else has either been franchised or they just kept their own, or people or were re-signed, as in the case of a guy like Joe Flacco. And there's still a number of veteran players that are out on the market, whether it be Carlos Dansby, Charles Woodson, Andre Smith, Richard Seymour, James Harrison, Dwight Freeney, just to name a few of veteran guys still available. Nnamdi Asamoah signs with the 49ers, a one-year deal. See a number of one-year deals. And you have guys hoping to hit the market again next year, hoping to have big years this year and then hit the market and receive those long-term contracts come next year. And, I mean, you got things. You have Damaris Smith, you know, wanting to see the latest cap numbers in terms of he believes that teams are lying about how much cap space they have. Listen, I have knocked NFL teams for years about giving out these ridiculous contracts come free agent time. And there have been a number of them. And certainly I've seen my share of them as being a Washington Redskins fan. We probably cornered the market on bad contracts during the decade of the 2000s or the early 2000s. So I'm not going to sit up here and criticize owners for how they spend their money. Because the flip side is when they give out bad contracts and complain about them, I'll say, well, they're the ones who gave out the bad contracts. So, and now they want to basically renege on them with the collective bargaining agreement or with lockouts and things of that nature. So I'm not going to sit up here and criticize an owner for not giving away tens of millions of dollars to aging players. And that's what this comes down to. The guys, you know, the Joe Flaccos of the world, the Mike Wallaces of the world, the main guys, the Aaron Rodgers of the world, those guys are going to get their money, point blank. They're going to get their money. The guys who are not getting paid are these veteran guys who either are over the hill, overrated, or have something to prove. You know, why would you give Nnamdi Asamoah, who once was considered to be a top corner, but the last 2 years has been mediocre, why would you give him a big contract? Based on what, exactly? What he used to be? What he was in 2010? Why would you give James Harrison or Dwight Freeney big-time money? Again, based on 2009, 2010, 2008? not how the NFL works. I don't care if you had, I don't care if I was a team that had cap space or not. Not just giving away money. So to me, it's not collusion. It's the NFL owners coming to their senses and not doing what NBA owners have been doing forever, and that's giving away money. Teams are putting more emphasis on drafting, player development, and less on building. And that's not how you build a team anyway, through free agency. Free agency, you plug a hole here, you plug a hole there. And number two, and more importantly, you can't tell somebody how to spend their money or how much money to spend. You know, Ed Reed signed a contract that, you know, this whole theory that they're keeping contracts down just because, you know, even if they are, so be it that they don't want to give Ed Reed, say, $15 million a year or $10 million a year. So I have zero problem with it. Zero. Good for them. And I mean, I don't see DeMar Smith crying about collusion in regards to Tony Romo's contract. I don't see that. I know he's not a free agent, but still. Don't see him crying about collusion about that. I didn't see him crying about collusion when Albert Haynesworth got $100 million, got $40 million guaranteed, basically off 2 good years. Now you didn't hear about that. No collusion on that one. We'll take a quick break, and then we're going to wrap up the program on this latest edition of the Silicon Review. We'll be right back. After the 1 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Silicon Review, of course, Final Four weekend, Wichita State, Louisville, Michigan, Syracuse in the second game. Listen, I think Wichita State is going to be in for a long night. I can see them hanging in for a half or so. I just don't think that they can handle the Louisville pressure for 40 minutes. Now, the thing that will keep Wichita State in this game is if either Silva or Russ Smith gets in major foul trouble. Because with Kevin Ware's loss, and the thing that's been lost, that has not been talked about enough, the fact that Kevin Ware was a very good player, and that he had been, you know, he had really given the guards some added depth to their backcourt. You take him away out the equation, and they, you know, Louisville will have to simmer their pressure down if either one of those guys gets in foul trouble, Silva or Russ Smith. Other than that, both of them are going to play in excess of 33, 34 minutes. I don't think Wichita State can handle Louisville pressure for 40 minutes. I like Wichita State a lot as far as with the toughness, you know, play angry, like the coach. But Louisville just wears on you. They really do. I mean, they mentally, it's more than physical, it's mentally just dealing with that pressure, you know, possession in and possession out. And, you know, now offensively they have guys, they have big men who are excellent passers, who can make mid-range shots. And they don't, I mean, Louisville does not have to make a lot of threes to be successful. That's the thing. You know, if you can't keep their guards in front of you, then you just have no chance. I think Wichita State will do a better job than Duke did in terms of keeping those guys in front of them. But it'll be one of the all-time Final Four upsets if Wichita State wins this game. I like Louisville by at least 10 points. Somewhere, like, I would say 69-56, that type of game. I don't think this game will ever be in doubt. So I think Louisville will play a national championship. Second game, I think, will be an excellent game. But I have to lean towards Syracuse. Syracuse, to me, has the number one weapon going to this Final Four, and that's their 2-3 zone. Boeheim has said it, that they're playing it better than they've ever played it in all his time at Syracuse, and that's saying a lot because they've had a lot of great teams that have played the zone, the 2-3 zone at a high level. I'll take the great defense over the great offense because dome, shooting background. Remember, teams tend to struggle shooting at the Final Four with these backgrounds and these, you know, 70,000 seat stadiums, and you know, just in general, sometimes you see some ugly games at the Final Four. Defense has been the theme of this tournament, and no team has played better defense statistically than Syracuse. So I think we're headed towards an all Big East, you know, the brawl for it all type matchup, number four between Louisville and Syracuse. I've thought that way for the majority of the tournament. I've thought that way since Syracuse beat Indiana. When Syracuse beat Indiana, I said we head towards a Louisville Syracuse national championship. That to me took me over the top in terms of that convinced me that Syracuse was going to make this type of run with that win over dominating win over Indiana. They played great basketball ever since. I see a Syracuse Louisville championship, the two best defensive teams, a Big East final. Both games, I think Syracuse Michigan game will be close. I think Louisville Wichita State game has a chance to get ugly, but looking forward to both games in Atlanta, and we'll see what happens. We'll see who will be playing on Monday night. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We will see you soon. Maybe we'll see you on Monday to preview the national championship. We'll see how that works out. Have a great Saturday. Enjoy the games. So long.